You're listening to DTFHN for March 4th, 2026. I'm your rigorously approximated host, Jack Hacksmith. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where someone is always 50 years late to an excellent point. Some ideas don't age past a peer pod. They wait. Feed's running. Let's go. The detail most people skipped in that headline is one word. Relockable. Unlocking a bootloader is easy. Manufacturers have allowed that for years, with varying degrees of reluctance. What almost none of them allow. What makes Graphene Codes on Pixel devices genuinely different from every other custom ROM story is relocking, the ability to install your own operating system and then cryptographically seal the device again, so that verified boot still runs, so that the hardware root of trust still holds, so that your phone still knows it's running exactly what you told it to run. That's not a minor feature. That's the entire security model. Here's the engineering picture. Android's verified boot chain starts at the bootloader. It checks a signature before handing off to the OS. When you unlock the bootloader to flash a custom image, most devices break that chain permanently. You get a warning on every boot, and more importantly, the hardware attestation that apps and services rely on is gone. Graphene OS on Pixel works differently because Google ships hardware support for user-controlled signing keys. You can install Graphene OS, relock with your own key, and the chain is intact. The phone knows it's running Graphene OS. Apps that check for a compromised device get a real, honest answer. Motorola committing to this. Bootloader unlock and relock with Graphene OS support. Means that verified boot becomes portable. It means a Motorola device running Graphene OS isn't a compromised device with a warning screen. It's a properly attested, cryptographically sound system that happens to run software its owner chose. The hardware support comment is accurate. Graphilos has been pixel first by necessity, not preference. The team has been explicit about this for years. They won't pretend a device is secure if the underlying hardware doesn't support the full security model. That's not perfectionism. That's honesty about what security actually requires. The tools exist now to do it right. Motorola is putting them in reach. Run this forward. Every manufacturer that commits to relock support is manufacturing a device that can be fully owned by its user. The baseband concerns some commenters raised are real and worth tracking, but the bootloader architecture is a necessary foundation, and Motorola just laid it. This is how the floor rises. From hardware to protocol, story 2 is living proof the floor keeps rising. RFC 9849 just made TLS encrypted client Hello official. In 2003, the IETF published RFC 35 sucks. The problem it solved was practical. How do you host multiple HTTPS sites on a single IP address? The answer was SNI. Server name indication. A small extension to the TLS handshake that announces in plain text which hostname you're connecting to. It worked. Virtual hosting scaled. The web got cheaper to run. It also meant that for the next 22 years, every TLS connection would begin with an unencrypted announcement. This client, at this moment, is connecting to this hostname. The body of the traffic, encrypted. The metadata, on the wire in clear text, readable by anyone watching. Your ISP, a government, a sensor with a firewall and a list. That is the gap RFC 9849 closes. That's EH. Encrypted client hello moves the sensitive parts of the TLS handshake inside an encrypted envelope. The client encrypts the inner client hello, including the real SNI, using a public key the server has published in DNS. What the network observes is a decoy, a client hello pointing at a public-facing host, carrying an encrypted payload that only the actual destination can open. The architecture requires HTTPS records in DNS. Key distribution, coordinated support on both ends. When it works, the real hostname disappears from the wire entirely. The comment from a reader about geo-blocking in India is worth stating plainly. Network-level censorship using SNI inspection is not theoretical. It is operational, deployed at scale, and it functions because the standard has carried this exposure for 2 decades. ECH doesn't improve abstract privacy in some future threat model. It removes a surveillance primitive that authoritarian networks have relied on as a matter of current infrastructure. The fingerprinting angle the comments surface is equally concrete. J3 and J4 hashes. Widely used signals in bot detection and traffic analysis are derived from TLS handshake fields that ECH restructures. Security tooling built on the assumption of readable TLS metadata will need to recalibrate. CADI supports it. Cloudflare is deploying it. DNS tooling is catching up. What RFC 9849 represents is a correction. 22 years after a deliberate architectural trade-off that was reasonable in context and has been exploited since, the trade-off was virtual hosting works, privacy doesn't. The correction is now a finalized standard. The window where SNI inspection is a reliable network control primitive is closing. SNI's era of quiet exposure ends. Now shift to something equally architectural, equally exciting. Story 3. Agentic Engineering Patterns. The strongest argument against what Simon Willison is describing in his Agentic Engineering Patterns. And I want to make this argument properly before I take it apart. Is that it's sophisticated cargo culting? You're mimicking the forms of engineering discipline while the actual cognitive substance has been delegated to a system you don't understand. Write tests, let the model make them pass. Iterate on prompts. Verify outputs. But if you never had to reason through the problem yourself, did you engineer anything? Or did you transcribe? That's the argument, and on its surface, it has teeth. Here's where it fails. The argument assumes that the cognitive work in software development is the act of writing code, that the discipline lives in the syntax, the implementation choices, the manual reasoning through data structures and edge cases. But that was always a means to an end, not the end itself. The end is a system that behaves correctly under conditions you've specified. Think about how structural engineering actually works. A bridge engineer doesn't pour the concrete. They don't operate the crane or thread the rebar. What they do? What constitutes the engineering? Is specifying tolerances, load requirements, failure modes, and the conditions under which a structure must hold. The execution is delegated. The discipline is in the specification and verification, in knowing precisely what correct means before the work begins. Agentic engineering patterns are teaching this exact reorientation. 2DD with a coding agent isn't test theater. It's forcing the specification to exist before execution. The agent is fast and often correct, and sometimes catastrophically wrong, which makes the test suite load-bearing in a way it wasn't, when you were writing both the tests and the code. The patterns Willison document. Scope constraints, iterative verification, structured task decomposition are all about being the engineer, not the laborer. The comments from practitioners confirm what you'd expect. Systems with high test coverage behave well in agentic loops. Systems without it drift. The discipline is an optional ornamentation. It's the actual substrate of control. This is a new role taking shape. The question worth sitting with is whether we teach it explicitly. In curricula, in onboarding, in how we review each other's work. or whether we let the gap between old mental models and new workflows produce a generation that never learned to specify correctly because they never had to. The tools are here. The discipline is catching up. Moving on. At what point does a performance optimization become the thing you optimize against? PostgreSQL at a JIT compilation in version 11. The idea was sound. Instead of interpreting expressions row by row, compile them to native code. Real speedups on heavy analytical workloads. The math checks out. Run this forward to your average production database. You have a query. It takes 4 milliseconds to execute. Postgres looks at it, decides JIT might help, and spends 30 milliseconds compiling before it runs. You have made a 4-millisecond query into a 34-millisecond query in the name of performance. The standard response to this was to set JIT of gov cost so high that JIT almost never fires. The community discovered, empirically, that the cure was worse than the disease for most workloads, so they turned it off and left it there. This is a specific category of engineering outcome. The feature shipped. It works correctly. It is genuinely faster at execution time. The problem is the other half of the equation, getting to execution time. LLM's compilation overhead is measured in tens to hundreds of milliseconds, sometimes seconds. Quote, for OLAP queries that run for minutes, that overhead is irrelevant. For OLAP queries that run for milliseconds, it's catastrophic by definition. What Vladich built with PG Jitter is the correction. 3 backends.
Sit, asmjit, you are fine.
With compilation times measured in microseconds, Sloutrick compiles in tens colons to low hundreds of microseconds and runs 5 to 25% faster than the interpreter across all workloads, as Binzit specializes in wide row deformation and pushes that to 32%. The benchmarks on superwide tables are genuinely alarming. LLM clocking in at 10 to 30 times baseline, while the lightweight backends are quietly doing their jobs with no drama whatsoever. Worth noting, this is not a rewrite. It's a drop-in provider. Set JIT provider, adjust JIT agov cost to something that reflects reality. A few hundred instead of 100,000. And the feature that has been sitting disabled in most production configs for 6 years starts pulling its weight. That's the unintended consequence completing its arc. Someone ships a solution too expensive to use. The community turns it off. Someone else builds the version the original always implied was possible. A repository appears, compiles in microseconds, and quietly makes good on a promise that had been outstanding since 2018. The tools exist. Someone put them where you can reach them. Story 5. Someone heard that same call to build the thing that implies it's possible, this time in F, and they're here to show their work. Building a text processing pipeline last year, I ran into the problem resolves with uncomfortable clarity. The pattern I needed was simple to describe. Strings containing one term and another term, but not a third. In English, 2 sentences. In regex, a tangle of look-aheads I wasn't entirely confident was correct. Running against a backtracking engine, I wasn't entirely confident wouldn't melt under load. Resirons resolves that problem. Not by being clever about the syntax. By being mathematically correct about what regex operators should exist in the first place. The history here is worth knowing. Nearly every regex engine alive today descends from one of 2 lineages, both decades old. Thompson's NFA construction from 1968 gives you linear time guarantees. Your pattern scales reliably with input size. Backtracking engines, the kind powering most production code, give you richer features, but surrender that guarantee. That surrender has a name, RIDAS, adversarial input. Exponential blow-up, denial of service. It's a real attack. People have shipped CVEs over it. What neither camp ever supported was intersection and complement. The ability to say, match strings that satisfy this and this. Match strings that do not satisfy this. The math for it existed in 1964 in a paper by Janusz Brzozowski, forgotten, rediscovered in 2009, forgotten again. Used internally at Microsoft for credential scanning in 2019 without being exposed to users. The operators were sitting in the codebase like a locked room. Reopens the room. It's built on Brzozowski derivatives. A construction that turns regex matching into a sequence of transformations, each reducing the pattern against the next character. Elegant in theory. Elegant in theory remakes it fast in practice. Memoization, symbolic character classes, careful cache management. The result is intersection, complement, context-aware lookaround.
All of it! With ON, time, complexity. Linear. Probably. It benchmarks faster than everything else on a large industry standard set. Not just .NET's engines. Every industrial regex engine in the comparison.
This just landed on NuGet, one import, the operators that were lost twice. That spent years locked inside a credential scanner no one could touch. They're in the package registry now. The paper is Popple 2025. The code is MIT. 60 years from publication to availability, genuinely worth the wait. Today's theme is apparently things that were theoretically possible, finally made real. Story 6 keeps that streak alive.
Multiplication is faster than addition. On this machine, anyway. By a factor of 12.
That single benchmark result is the needle that threads the entire NCPU project. Because if you've spent any time with hardware, that sentence should feel wrong. Addition is primitive. Addition is the bedrock. Multiplication is built on top of it, slower, more expensive. That's been true since 1971. It's been true since von Neumann. It's been true since Feynman started writing down algorithms. Here's what changed. The unit of computation. NCPU is a CPU that lives entirely on the GPU registers. Memory, program counter.
PyTorch tensors. Every arithmetic operation. Not approximated. Not offloaded. Fully routed.
Through a trained neural network, ADD calls a carry lookahead network with 8 sequential passes. MUL calls a byte pair lookup table with 0 sequential dependency. That's why multiplication wins. The lookup table has no carry chain to propagate. It's embarrassingly parallel in a way addition fundamentally isn't.
Strip it to first principles. What is a carry look ahead adder actually doing?
It's computing prefix sums over the carry bits. Even the best classical implementation has O log N sequential stages you cannot parallelize away. Kogestone is the gold standard specifically because it minimizes those stages.
And it still requires 8 passes in the neural version. The physics of carry propagation don't care whether you're in silicon or in weight matrices.
That's what this project reveals, almost accidentally. Classical hardware design principles transfer directly. The engineers who worked out parallel prefix adders in the 1970s were solving a real constraint. And that constraint didn't evaporate when you moved the computation to tensors. The same trade-offs, the same bottlenecks, just expressed in a different substrate. The obvious objection.
Why train a neural network for operations the GPU already handles in silicon? Is technically valid and also slightly beside the point. The point is, it works. 100% accuracy on integer arithmetic, verified across 347 tests. 23 trained models, 135 megabytes total, loading in 60 milliseconds. The whole thing runs in Python. Open source, pip install, and you're running Fibonacci through a learned adder. Is it fast? No. Roughly 5,000 instructions per second against the billions your laptop does without trying. But the Cogstone finding? That you can recover a 3x speedup by applying 50-year-old parallel prefix theory to neural carry chains. That's not a curiosity. That's a research result. The abstraction layers changed. The physics didn't. From the math of how machines think. Pause. To the math of how machines draw. The rendering equation is one page long. Kajiya published it in 1986, and in that single expression, the integral of radiance over a hemisphere, weighted by the cosine of the angle and the bidirectional reflectance distribution function. He described every pixel that has ever been rendered correctly. Every photon simulation, every path tracer, every production renderer at every VFX house on Earth is solving or approximating that one equation. Follow the principle to its extreme. Implement it exactly, and your renderer is perfect. You also need infinite samples, infinite time, and infinite compute. The equation is correct. The physics is solved. The entire field of graphics programming is the science of approximating that integral well enough that a human eye cannot tell the difference. And doing it fast enough to be useful. That gap between theoretically exact and actually runs is where 30 years of research lives. Monte Carlo methods, variance reduction, bidirectional path tracing, photon mapping, BVH acceleration structures that subdivide geometry into bounding hierarchies so your ray doesn't test every triangle in the scene. Just the ones it might actually hit. Each technique is an answer to the same question. How close can we get how fast? What this curated resource list represents is the full stack of that knowledge, assembled and freely available. The Kajiya paper is there. So is PBRT. The textbook that turned physically-based rendering from research into practice, ray tracing in one weekend, which compresses the core insight into something you can build in an afternoon. Dartmouth CS87 filling the gap between toy renderer and production system. The CMU lectures on Monte Carlo rendering and variance reduction. The BVH series walking through the acceleration structure that powers basically every ray tracer running today. Vulkan specs and guides for when you're ready to talk directly to the GPU. One commenter noted there's nothing on volumetrics. Another wanted more material for FrameBerha-only embedded systems, working without a GPU at all. These are real gaps. The list scavs toward the modern GPU accelerated stack. Valid criticism from people doing different work at a different level of the abstraction tower. But here is what's worth naming. The foundation is open. The papers, the textbooks, the tutorials, the specifications. Most of it is freely available if you know where to look. This list is someone doing the work of knowing where to look, then pointing. The rendering equation doesn't care who you work for, neither does physics. From the cosmic sweep of rendering physics, story 8 lands us firmly in the weeds. Someone's scheduler was losing wake-ups. They built a zero-copy Kuru tracer to find out why. The post has no comments yet. Which is interesting in its own way, because lost wake-ups in MN schedulers are precisely the kind of problem that attracts engineers with very strong feelings and very specific war stories. Here's the situation Cora Tracer was built for. You have a scheduler. Under heavy load, throughput drops to zero. Asan finds nothing. San finds nothing. Every sanitizer you run tells you memory is clean. Threads are clean. Everything is fine. But the program is frozen. Coroutines stuck indefinitely, waiting on a file descriptor that was already closed. The state machine broke. Nothing caught it because nothing was looking at the right layer of abstraction.
The obvious counterargument. You don't need a new tool. You need to write better code. Lost wakeups are bugs in your scheduler's state management. Fix the state management.
That argument fails on contact with the actual problem. You cannot fix what you cannot see. The sanitizers are not wrong.
There is no memory error. There is no data race. The error is logical. A sequence of state transitions became invalid. The existing toolchain has no instrument that operates at that layer. CoroTracer was built because a whole category of bug is genuinely invisible to everything that already exists.
The architecture reflects that constraint. The target application writes state changes into pre-allocated shared memory using lock-free structures, event slots sized to 64-byte cache lines.
Matching CPU cache lines exactly, eliminating false sharing during concurrent writes. A separate Go engine reads this data out of process. No context switches into the target. No serialization overhead. When the engine is idle, the SDK checks a single atomic flag before sending a 1-byte Unix domain socket signal to wake it. This prevents syscall storms at high throughput by checking before touching. The result is a trace file. The analyzer runs heuristics, detects the lost wakeup, generates a markdown report or an interactive HTML dashboard. The bug that was invisible to every standard instrument becomes locatable.
Out-of-process observation of a process you cannot afford to perturb. The author built this because the bug existed and nothing else caught it. That is the correct reason to build a tool.
The post is quiet. The problem it solves has been loud for anyone who has stared at a frozen scheduler with clean sanitizer output and no explanation for why everything stopped.
Debugging blind spots in one system. Now something that might help us see inside a very different one. Story 9, Claude's Cycles.
Shock! Shock!
Those are the first two words of the paper, written by Donald Knuth, the man who has been producing technical prose of extraordinary precision for 6 decades. The author of The Art of Computer Programming, who, 2 years ago, told Stephen Wolfram he would certainly continue to leave such research to people who are young and impressionable. Two words. And they open a paper named after an AI. Here is what happened. Knuth had a conjecture.
A graph decomposition problem connected to work he's been doing on a new volume of TAOCP. A student named Philip asked Claude Opus 4.6 to work on it. 31 explorations, roughly 1 hour. Claude generated examples.
Specific cases, structures, patterns. Knuth looked at what came back, recognized the shape of something, and wrote the formal proof himself.
The paper is called Claude's Cycles because the cycles are real, the contribution is real, and Knuth named it honestly. And here is the question nobody seems to want to ask directly. What does solved mean? Because the HN comments are already dividing. One person says the framing is misleading.
Claude generated examples. Knuth generalized. Another says that's exactly what a good collaborator does.
Dald says that Claude got stuck on the even case entirely. In the end, it was not even able to write down the pattern. So Claude held one half of the problem and dropped the other. Knuth carried it home.
The question isn't whether this proves AI is transformational or proves it's a glorified example generator. The question is why we need it to be one or the other. Why we need to assign the theorem to a single author?
Human or machine?
Rather than look clearly at what actually happened. A person used a tool in a way the tool's creators probably didn't plan for.
and something new came out. Yunuth closes the paper with this line. It seems I'll have to revise my opinions about generative AI one of these days.
He is 86 years old. He has been right about more things in computer science than almost anyone alive. And he looked at evidence and updated. That is not a small thing. That is how it's supposed to work. New data arrives. You revise. The question is whether the rest of us can do the same.
In both directions. And what better proof of an open mind than going back to where Knuth started?
Story 10, his 1974 paper on the design of programming languages. 1974. Watergate is unraveling. The last Apollo mission is 2 years in the past. And Niklos Wirth is writing a paper arguing that programming languages should serve human readers. You can see where this is going.
The paper is short, dense with good sense. It makes the case that a language is not just an instruction set for machines.
It is a notation for human thought that clarity is not a luxury, that the language shapes what you can think, not just what you can execute. These ideas had been in the air since Nagel's 60. The best minds in the field.
Dijkstra, Hoare, M.C. Carthy, Wirth himself
had been circling this thesis for a decade. They had the receipts, they had the theory, they had working languages that demonstrated the principles. Then the market happened. C was fast. C was portable. C was tied to Unix, which spread through universities like...
Well, like something that spreads very quickly, Pascal ran on academic machines. C ran on everything else. By the mid-80s, the argument was over. Not because the principles were wrong, because the distribution won. This is the comedy. Wirth was right. The languages he and his contemporaries designed.
Pascal Modula 2, Oberon,
are more readable, more principled, more amenable to human understanding in the descendants of C that most of us write in today. He was right, and the field ignored him anyway. And we live with the consequences in every stack trace, every buffer overflow, every null pointer exception that should not be possible in a well-designed language. Someone in the comments asks, who are the Wirths and Dijkstras of today? That question deserves an honest answer. They exist. They are writing papers. They are building languages.
Rust, Zig, Ling, Gleam.
That take the book 1974 arguments seriously. The principles did not die. They went underground for 40 years and came back wearing different clothes. The bootstrapism angle here is not subtle. Language design is the deepest layer of the stack. Whoever controls the language controls what can be expressed. The great equalizer is a language anyone can implement. Read, extend, where, tumpf. Wirth understood this. The market understood something else.
The paper is 50 years old and still worth your afternoon. That is either an indictment of how little we have learned, or proof that good ideas are patient.
This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 4th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go make something worth reaching for. We'll see you back here tomorrow.